Hi, you're listening to the Self-Hostcast, a podcast dedicated to all things self-hosted. Today, I'm sitting down with Dan Brown, open source advocate and developer of the popular documentation platform Bookstack. Thanks for listening. Hey, everyone, and thanks for listening to the Self-Hostcast. My name is Ethan, and today I'm joined by Dan Brown, the developer of Bookstack and several other open source projects. Dan, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Yeah, so for those who are listening who might not be familiar with some of your work, do you mind giving us just a quick rundown of some of the projects you've worked on and where you spend your time?
Sure. So I think most people would know my work from, as you mentioned, Bookstack, which I started off in 2015 and first shared with the self-hosting community, specifically the self-hosting subreddit, at the start of 2016. So almost a decade of development getting on that project. So that's fairly well established, and that's my most popular project. But then I tend to end up building various other little bits out there and making them open source whenever I have a scenario which I need an application for, and maybe I can't find something out there to suit my exact need. Other applications you might come across is my RSS app, just a nice kind of Twitter-style RSS reader, as well as various other bits, like I've got a mail sender thing that I created for sending newsletters for Bookstack. Plus, I originally got into development via developing a few little Android applications as well, mainly around temperature sensors, because that was my career at the time. So yeah, a whole kind of random variety of bits can be found on my GitHub and Codeberg profiles.
Yeah, that's great. I have to say, I'm excited for our conversation today. I'm a big fan of Bookstack. I'm a big fan of RSS, but I suppose no one else would know this aside from you and myself. But as from week to week, as I do my research and prepare content for my newsletter, I occasionally reach out to Dan on Mastodon and to pick his brain and thoughts when something's going on with, especially open source licensing. You do a lot of work with that and just challenging other folks to make sure they're using it correctly and that it's not being abused. And inevitably, when something comes up, my gut instinct is always to reach out to Dan and ask for his thoughts on something. And it's been very valuable. So thank you for that. I'd love to get into that a little bit later, actually. But want to talk a little bit about Bookstack and RSS and some of the work you do with that. I traditionally like to start off with a little bit of an icebreaker. And so as I was doing some research for this recording, I stumbled upon actually a Wikipedia article for Bookstack. I don't know if you knew that existed, but it's funny in kind of a meta way that Bookstack is used for documentation and a wiki, and it has its own Wikipedia page. And I don't know who's maintaining it, if it's you or someone else, but there's actually a ton of Wikipedia information for all of the self-hosted wikis. And maybe it's just the nature of them being a wiki, but do you have any input or say into the Bookstack Wikipedia page?
Oh, I think I might have tweeted it once, like in the past. But no, I can't take credit for the majority of it. It's really just people out there, you know, adding value to Wikipedia, really. I think there's a certain person, I can't exactly remember the profile name, but they originally created it and have done a lot of maintenance on that since. So a lot of credit out to that individual that's helped maintain that page. And I assume that they probably maintain quite a lot of other pages if they're doing one on something as somewhat niche as Bookstack. Yeah, they're probably adding a lot of value onto Wikipedia.
Yeah, that Wikipedia work is always impressive. But as I was scrolling through the page, and I'll link it in the show notes for this recording, this episode, they have some pretty specific information on there, even as far as the number of languages it's available in. And in my mind, I'm like, is this person just monitoring all of the releases? And every time you add a translation, it's like, oh, let me go update the Wikipedia page and make sure everything's up to speed. It has programming languages. I just thought that was super interesting. And I feel like if it were me, I'd be looking at the Wikipedia page every day just to see what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know if they've got any kind of automation on there. I'm always impressed by whenever I do end up looking on there. It's usually when I have to like write a blog article and I'm trying to find out when I first started Bookstack, I go into the Wikipedia article, which then references something that I said, you know, a decade ago.
That's incredible.
But I'm always impressed by how recently updated the like version number is, like after release. So, either someone's got some good automation on the go, or yeah, they're putting in the good effort of keeping it current and up to date.
Yeah. So can we actually talk about Bookstack a little bit? And you and I were talking a little bit and kind of joking before the episode. Bookstack has a very good reputation in some online communities. And you were joking that it may be just more of a bubble with certain communities, but I don't think I've ever heard a bad thing about Bookstack. People love it. People love the structure of, or the idea of organizing their documentation like a book. So do you mind just talking a little bit about that? Maybe where that idea came from, what the inspiration was, and what it's like to do that? Because I'm pretty sure you are working full time on Bookstack, correct?
Yeah, as of now, pretty much. It's like full time. I don't kind of treat it as a full time job. But yeah, I left my previous job in like 2021. But it was at that job that I first come up with the idea of, creating a documentation system, because I've kind of found this need within our company that we were just storing random bits in so many different platforms. It might be in Dropbox, on SharePoint, in Word documents, on GitHub. It was just content was all over the place. So I was just, it was under an initiative, okay, let's get everything into one platform. So of course the first thing is what platform do you choose? And I just looked across the available options, and the most obvious one was Atlassian. I can never remember how to say that name of that company, but it's their Confluence is their product.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the kind of main, nice, easy to use big offering out there for the kind of documentation that I wanted to store. But I mean, it's a paid for service and they have per user licensing costs, which to me was really something I didn't want, because I think it might have been like free up to five seats originally, and then anything more than that, you need to start paying. But I didn't want to have to go through that process of contacting the finance department of the company to allow people to have access to a documentation, or find janky workarounds like you might end up doing this in some scenarios.
Right.
I really didn't want our documentation to be gated under a price and a process. So I had a look at what alternative offerings were out there, especially in the open source space. So I had a little review, and the closest at the time would have been really Doku Wiki, which is a great project and it's still going on. And for my particular use case, I wanted something that was nice and easy to use for all members of the company, not just the tech department that I was in, but also, the client services department and the consultants and things like that up to management. So I didn't want something where you'd be writing like Markdown or some other kind of markup. I didn't want to have to start teaching lessons about how to create documentation. So I
Right.
wanted, my kind of idea was if someone could use Word, I wanted them to be able to use this platform. So looking at DocuWiki, that could kind of get there with a bunch of plugins. But my concern was kind of, I don't know enough about the platform without then, maintaining it for a year or so. How are those plugins maintained? Do they have official support? Are they going to be trouble to use with the platform? So I didn't want to be 1 year in and find that we've got a kind of unmaintainable or unstable system because of having to get to what I need by adding plugins to the system. At least, changing to our use case, because I'm sure DokuWiki as it comes is great for a lot of use cases.
Right.
So, I was a young, eager developer. I've been developing probably for, a whole 2 years at that point. I knew everything. So I thought, how hard can this be? It's just a database connected up to a WYSIWYG editor. That's
Yeah,
easy.
easy.
I don't know. Well, there's nothing to it really, is there? So I started building that, and I mean, then I'm still maintaining that 9 years on. And I'm still trying to connect up that database to the WYSIWYG editor. So it ended up being, as everything is, there's always more to it. But to be honest, from the start to your usable platform, that was a 6 month time. My vast majority of building was in that time. A lot of the fundamentals are still the same as they were then. But it did develop a few times along that process, because originally I kind of built it like a developer and somewhat copying some of the things that I saw in other platforms. For example, initially, when you created like a page of documentation, then you could create pages within that page. So it's like an infinitely nestable stack to any depth that you wanted. And technically, that's great. You know, from a developer point of view, it's infinite. You know, you don't have to worry about the structure because there's infinite levels. Everything's great because it's so, I don't know, recursive. But when I was kind of assessing that for an actual usability point of view for the audience that I wanted, I realized that that really doesn't help from a user experience point of view, because when you have this kind of infinitely nestable depth, although infinity is great, technically, it's also easy to lose things in infinity. And you can do things to kind of help, like tagging a search, but those are extra things that you need to depend upon or extra process to enforce, like proper tagging rules.
Right.
So I found really you need to build, for kind of user experience that I was after, you need to kind of a fixed depth. So then that's when I kind of introduced books and then chapters and then with pages being the content at a fixed depth, because I thought by having, you know, those three certain layers is that you can build the UI around that kind of depth, and then users will be familiar with that depth. And again, the whole naming term was to provide a familiar paradigm with something real world, so that you could onboard users and say, yeah, you know, you've got your books, your chapters and pages, just like a normal book, and your text is in the pages, and that's kind of instantly transferable. And you never know, or you never think about having to search beyond that level of depth. There's always, you know, three levels beneath the surface maximum. And that's really what formulated Bookstack. And then I kind of, yeah, built the whole design and the whole thinking around that concept. And yeah, that's what I eventually released with early 2016.
Wow, I didn't realize it's been around that long. Do you get a lot of feedback about the limited depth that Bookstack provides, maybe versus other things, good or bad?
Yep. Because it is a limitation at the end of the day. And when people are faced with limitations, they want to break through the limitations. There's a lot of use cases that don't fit into that, especially when people are transferring in for something else that doesn't have that limitation, because it will feel like a limit. But it's something that I feel is quite core to the platform for the whole purpose of discoverability and user experience, being able to build the UI around that. Now, I'm not saying that's the best thing for everyone, and that's why we have different options of different platforms out there. I think it's, if someone really needs that, then probably Bookstack isn't for them. And that's something that I'm quite honest as well when people are talking about it on Reddit. I will say that if I'm going to recommend it, I usually qualify that with just be aware the design and the structure is very opinionated. So probably assess that as your primary thing to see if it's going to work out for you. Yeah, and I still get requests for that extra level. And that's what I originally got to what ended up to become Shelves. So, because it was books, chapters, and pages, and those were three levels of depth. But got a lot of feedback from people wanting just one more level. So I thought, fine, let's try and make that unique. So I had Shelves, and they're a bit different, a bit funky. And in hindsight, I probably would have made some changes to that. But so that's, yeah, now four levels of depth you can kind of achieve. But then, of course, as soon as Shelves are added, everyone wants just one more level. So that's kind of like my limit at that point. You know, if that doesn't suit you, then yeah, maybe back Bookstack isn't the right option for your use case.
Yeah, I was trying, as you were speaking, I was trying to think, okay, if you're adding additional levels, what would they be? I was trying to go the other way with, okay, what's one level lower than pages, but Shelves and up makes sense as well. And now I'm like, what would the next level be? Like rooms? These are the shelves you keep in the rooms of a house, and then you have rooms,
libraries.
And then you have library. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been thinking about making like an April Fool's video where I introduce this, but like in a very like VC, you know, Californian startup kind of way, like introducing Bookstack, stack of books for Bookstack Enterprise Edition. And yeah.
Please do that.
I think you could kind of wire it up with like a bunch of Docker containers. So if you click into a page, you can do some magic in the background, instantly start a whole new Bookstack instance that then jumps you into. But yeah, but in terms of what Bookstack is, yeah, I think I found what I'm happy with. Otherwise, if you change it so much, it's not going to be Bookstack anymore.
Right. Do you use Bookstack? Do you have like a production instance of Bookstack you use for your own documentation?
So documentation is a funny thing, because there's so many different use cases and ways to document stuff. So I do use Bookstack, and I use it kind of as my long-term note system storage for anything that I need to note long term. So stuff like about my car, about my home, about my cat, just things like that that I'll need to refer back to. But I wouldn't use it for absolutely everything. For example, I don't use it for like coding projects because it just makes sense to use like probably markdown files that are stored in the repository with them.
Right.
So I'm a big believer in like not trying to force a use case to use something. Use it where it makes sense. And it's in the same case, I get some stick for not using Bookstack for the Bookstack documentation because that is a Hugo, so a static site generator, based off of markdown files, because that's built as part of the website as a whole. And it didn't really make sense to me for that as a use case for Bookstack, because although it's documentation, it's not the kind of documentation that I built Bookstack for. It's not multi-user, it's not slightly more collaborative, and the presentation and output that I wanted for the website was quite fixed, and it's really just me developing that, and I want to develop that as part of the website. So I didn't want a bad use case put front and center for Bookstack, which I believe it would present if I was using it for that case. But my initial use of Bookstack was at my job, so we did implement it at my past job, and I believe from what I last heard a few months ago, that is still running. So that would be the oldest instance of Bookstack in existence.
Wow. Oh, that's great. I was a little nervous to ask that question at first because I thought it might have been a stupid question, but I'm glad I asked because that was a great answer. Very insightful. Documentation and wikis, platforms and software like that, I'm always, or at least when I first started self-hosting, I struggled with it a bit because my concern was I don't want to document everything in my own self-hosted infrastructure with all the vital information that I need, because when my infrastructure crashes, how do I access that documentation? And that was my fear when I found some platforms where everything was stored, especially when it was stored in just like a database or something where it wasn't easy to get to. I like the platforms where you have the option of writing and storing in Markdown, and you can still get to it if something crashes. But that was a struggle for me for a while, and I've gotten more comfortable with that. But I think, like you, I've found a nice balance of, hey, I have software, kind of a couple different things that I use for note taking and documentation, Bookstack included, that have different purposes. And then I have backups and alternatives should something like that crash, or something.
Yeah, I think that's a common concern in the self-hosted space, because I see that a lot of times when people are asking about documentation and when Bookstack comes up, a lot of people say they didn't choose it because it does run on a database, and that does make it more fragile. And I can completely understand that as well. Though so far I haven't heard of a single instance of full corruption that we haven't been able to get people out of. I've managed to save a few instances. Just where things have gone wrong with their MySQL instance. But it's still harder to access if it isn't a MySQL database, and you do have to be more on top of it to export it in a more fundamental format. So yeah, that's something that comes up, and I do wonder about that, because that's not something that I changed like what Bookstack fundamentally is to suit, because it's kind of a different use case. Because Bookstack does depend on a database. Because I did think about this early on about whether I should just use text files. But for the amount that I was trying to do, you'd eventually essentially be creating your own database format through text files to do everything. So I really just
Right.
focused on using a standard database, because then people can use standard tooling and standard hosting options and things like that around that. But then I did build some things in to help with those use cases. So for example, there's the API in Bookstack where we've even got a script that people can just use as an example that will just export all the books from their instance to PDFs or markdown files or HTML files, so that you can just put that on a cron job and have a kind of an offline backup of everything. Or you can kind of use our extension system, so every time you save a page, it writes it out into the file system as well. So yeah, there are options, but I can totally understand why that might be a thing that puts people off Bookstack if they're using it for something, or telling if they're using it to document how to get books that working when it breaks. Yeah.
Right. I think I remember the first time I ran Bookstack, it's been several years now. I had found someone, and maybe the repo is still out there somewhere, someone had written a Python script to export all of the pages in a Bookstack instance as, I don't know if they were HTML pages or just markdown files or what. It would connect to Bookstack, grab all the pages, and then put them somewhere. And so I was like, oh, that's great. I'm spinning up Bookstack, and then I'm dumping them into cloud storage. I remember at some point being like, why am I doing this? Why don't I just store them directly in cloud storage? And so that kind of put me through like a mini wiki existential crisis for a bit. But I've since kind of alleviated that fear I have. I have better backup strategies. And I'm not super concerned about it now. But it's interesting. I feel like wikis and documentation software are probably, aside from Google Photos replacements, one of the things I see requested the most on Reddit, on Mastodon. People are constantly asking for it. And it's almost analysis paralysis, because there are a lot of great platforms out there that people can use. And it's amazing how innovative some have been, because a lot of them are vastly different, like Bookstack, and they all have their pros and cons. I didn't realize how old Bookstack was until you mentioned 2016, but I do know it's mature. I've kind of watched it mature and hit all the, or a lot of the major features, at least I would look for in software like that. What's on the roadmap for Bookstack anymore? What are the, if you can share that, or I don't know, maybe you're kind of holding it close, but what are your next big goals for Bookstack as far as development and features? Or do you feel like you're really at a point where maybe you're just maintenance and keeping up with everything else for the time being?
No, there's a lot of directions that we can move in. There's a lot that can be done with Bookstack and make it more valuable to existing audience. But to be honest, when it comes to like a roadmap, I'm not someone that puts something that really details the next like five steps. I did try to do that before, but I've now like removed the roadmap section of the readme, just because it never goes to plan, and it gives a kind of false idea, and it doesn't stop people asking on every single issue thread if this is going to be implemented in the next release.
Naturally.
So, I mean, it has got to a point of stability, really, where, I mean, that is an essential thing for me, where stability reigns supreme over new features. So anything that needs to be done in terms of maintenance work and keeping the core up to date, that will take over, because features tend to be more built towards new users, whereas that maintenance work is more important to the existing people that are on it, which is what I want to focus on. So, yeah, I can't say anything in terms of features. There's various bits here and there. But the thing that I'm working on at the moment is a replacement for the core page editor right now, because the existing editor that we use, a project called TinyMCE, which is quite a popular kind of WYSIWYG editor library, it switched out its license this year to one that's now incompatible with Bookstack's license. So they switched to a GPL license as Bookstack's MIT, which means I can no longer use that, at least from new versions going onwards that they're now releasing. So that, you know, a bit of a mild panic when seeing that. There are things that you can do around that. Like, I could switch to GPL myself, but I don't believe in changing the whole philosophy of our licensing just because of one library. And also, that library has made some changes over the years. Like, they've gone from LGPL to MIT and now to GPL, and they've moved some of the stuff out into a paid offering. And basically, my trust isn't fully there. But that said, I've had a lot of value from them over the last 9 years or so. So currently, I'm trying to build a replacement for the core editor. So that's taking up most of my time at the moment. And then that'll be a slow rollout as well, because again, stability is key. So I'm going to do it kind of a phased approach where the editors run alongside each other, and then we'll make the new editor the new default at some stage, and then eventually we'll get rid of the old editor. So that's quite a process. But yeah, but there's loads that I do want to do in the future, because there are some things that kind of lack within Bookstack. Like multi-language support is quite a cool one in terms of the content. The UI supports multiple languages. So you can choose a different language as a user and it translates the user interface. But in terms of content, be able to create a page and then that's specifically the same page but in multiple languages, that isn't something that's currently supported. But it's also very complex at this stage of the project. So I've been putting off that one a while, and I probably will do for a while longer, to be honest. There's some extra little things with the user permission system, like being able to share content via a link and maybe assign permissions at a user level. But again, the permissions are already a complete, complex mess of a machine, really, that I've spent quite a lot of time, got quite burnt out on that last year. So, but it's just take things as they come. I have a look at our issue list and see what's mostly requested, and then I go from there. So it's usually just based on what fits the platform and what our existing user base asking for.
Have you thought about, and I know some people will probably roll their eyes when they hear me talk about this. Have you thought about AI and at all, and how you might implement that? And I'm asking from the perspective as I'm a little exhausted from AI, and I feel like I monitor a ton of projects for my website, my newsletter. And I often see projects roll out AI, and I'm thinking to myself, why? Like, what purpose is that doing? It feels a little overkill for what I would expect that platform to be. But I do feel like documentation might be one of those areas that lends itself to some form of AI integration. And truthfully, I haven't done a lot of research into what other platforms are doing. I'm just curious, have you considered that, or what role that might play within Bookstack's ecosystem?
Yeah, for sure. And it's not something that I wanted to jump onto for the sake of saying Bookstack now has AI in it.
Thank you.
So I've been quite apprehensive to go really quite slow and observe what's happening in the landscape and how things evolve, because I kind of still evolving at a fair pace in terms of what options there are and who are the leaders and what are the more important part, what are the interfaces, how do these things work, how is training of existing content done. So yeah, it's not something which I particularly want to jump into. And it's not something that I'm too keen to build directly into Bookstack itself, as in terms of the actual AI or any kind of AI engine, just because that complicates the requirements. It expands our scope of responsibilities quite a lot, and I don't want that extra kind of burden on the project itself. But how I kind of envision things working is, once things are fairly stable, is that we'll likely create some specific methods of extensions or specific APIs that can essentially allow adapters onto different AI offerings. So people can write an adapter for, I don't know, OpenAI or Google's one, or self-hosted Llama LLM, and have things work that way, just so the burden of responsibility isn't on us, but so that we allow the possibilities to occur. And you can already kind of do some of that. So last year I had a play with this. I came across an open source project called Dancer. And this is a thing where you can, well, it connects to various things. So it connected to Confluence, Slack, I think maybe Gmail, various other things. So I spent a day or two writing a Bookstack connector for that. And so it would just launch up. It would consume everything out of your Bookstack instance by the API. And then via that platform, you could interface with your Bookstack data via an LLM, just via natural queries. And that seemed to work quite well. But that's probably the kind of approach that I take, you know, let external platforms do the heavy lifting. Because as soon as you get into doing things like fully featured to a production level within a platform like Bookstack, there's soon comes up a lot of difficult questions. I mean, it's mainly around permissions and the roles and things like that. It's essentially like how visibility works, who can query what content in the system, which makes anything like an external or additional search engine quite a pain point. So yeah, nothing in the core platform, but definitely open to providing those interfaces and options for external options to be tacked onto your Bookstack instance.
Got it. Got it. I know we've talked about Bookstack for a little bit. I want to pivot in just a minute, but I do want to ask you one last question. You did leave your job several years ago, and you're working on, you said, mostly Bookstack full time. Where does the financial support come from? Is it from support for enterprise customers, or is it just from customers who use the project and are sponsors because it's helpful and valuable to them? Do you mind speaking to that a little bit?
Sure. So it comes from a bit of a mix. So, I mean, when I originally left my job in 2021, October, I was taking some donations via GitHub, but it was rather minimal. And with a lot of those, I was just forwarding onto projects that Bookstack depends on, because I never really want to get money involved, but I saw that could be a way that money could be helpful. It's just to take money and then help support the projects that we depend on within Bookstack. So yeah, they had a little bit of income coming from that, but it's maybe $100 to $200 or so, and then a month, that would be. And then for the first 6 months after leaving, because that was my original plan, just kind of like an experiment for 6 months to see how things can work out. And against my own advice, my parents supported me for a while as well. So they like covered my living cost for the first 6 months.
Aww.
Even though I told them it's, you know, they might as well just throw their money down a well as far as I'm concerned.
That's so sweet of them.
But yeah, that was really nice of them. So I had that support initially as well. But during that time, the sponsors did grow a bit. So I made those a bit more official. So I set up some proper sponsor tiers. So you had ones that, like, I think my level was $100, $500, and $250 per month. And so I started getting a few of those sponsors, which, you know, added up to a fair bit. And then it wasn't so much of a loss if I was to work on it full time. So I thought, let's try and push it a bit further. So then I started the Bookstack support offerings. So there's a couple of tiers of that, which is, I think, £450 per year, or £4,500 per year, for you get different levels of support. And so I launched those, and yeah, I got a few buyers on those. So then that 6 months turned into a lot longer, and I just carried it on to see how far we could take it. So in 2022, I was dipping into my savings by quite a bit just to cover my living costs. But that was fine. But then in 2023, by year end, or on average over the year, I pretty much covered my living costs, which was great. And then in 2024, though, up to now this year, I think by this point I would have probably had more overall revenue than I did in the whole of 2023. So it's continuing to climb up. So I should, you know, exceed my living costs by quite a bit. So now I'm actually making a bit of an extra income, which is absolutely fantastic. And that's a lot of that's from those support contracts building up. So within 2023, I think by the end they're about even, like half and half, half donations and sponsorships and half support services. And now, because there's a lot of or there's a fair bit of retention in those support services year on year, they help kind of build up over time. So now they're probably the majority of my income or Bookstack.
How much of your time would you say you spend developing versus support for Bookstack?
That is I know which way it lands. So it's way more time spent on support. And that isn't just because of professional support. It's a lot more time spent on the community support method. So time spent on Discord, on Reddit, on GitHub especially. That is the majority of the time. And then, development is a more minor part these days. And that's actually been the case for quite a while, soon after starting the project. Because as soon as you get to a certain point of popularity, there's a lot to handle. And that's one of the things that really shocked me when starting Bookstack, or when sharing it across, is just how much of the work is the kind of community and social elements, rather than getting on and just building out something and getting into the core code.
Yeah, sure. This is something I frequently ask people on the podcast about, because I think if I were in your position, I think if I were a developer, even the little content I do put out there, support, the idea of support terrifies me. The idea of having to dedicate time to it. And I think that's probably a good segue, because I often think about the other open source project you've built and released in the last several years that has gained some popularity, your RSS platform, which is just called RSS, by the way, and always throws me off because it's hard to talk about it, especially in my newsletter when things happen, without getting people to understand, like, this is an actual piece of software I'm talking about. It's not just the protocol of RSS itself.
Yeah, but I've got some feedback on that, but, you know, naming's hard. I sat there trying to think of a good name, but then I just thought, do you know what? I'm just spending too much time on this. I'm just going to call it RSS and be done with it. But it's, I don't know, I quite like the hijinks that it's caused since.
Yeah, no, well, I certainly appreciate it in a very sarcastic way. But I like RSS a lot. I've used it both personally, and I've used it historically on my site for some things. Mostly because I'm a bit of an RSS and news junkie, so I'm constantly trying to find new ways of ingesting news. And it is a great piece of software, but it's also simultaneously super frustrating to me because it's, in my mind, for the use case I want, it's like 95% of the way there. And I'm always like, okay, if it had this and this, it would be perfect. But I've seen the GitHub discussions and the issues that you've closed on RSS repo, where you're saying, hey, it's where I want it to be. I'm not taking any feature requests, which I completely understand. And I guess the point is how I got on this topic is that I feel like that's probably how I would be were I to ever develop and release an open source project, because I don't know that I have the willpower or desire to support and answer all the questions and entertain all the feedback requests. Maybe that would change if I were in your shoes or in the shoes of someone who does it. Maybe there's certain joy in that when you release a really great piece of software and interacting with the community. But from my perspective, I completely respect the stance you've taken with RSS.
Yeah, I mean, there's simultaneously a fantastic and frustrating thing with performing your work and open source and sharing it out in the public is that kind of interaction, because it's great to share things with the community, it's great to work together, it's great to get feedback. But at some point, it can get to be quite a lot. And that's certainly something that I experienced with Bookstack. And, you know, with Bookstack, I've got to a point where I thought, you know, I can dedicate the time and I want to spend the time on this. And that's what I do. I help people. I support random configuration issues on someone's specific Kubernetes cluster. But you have to kind of set the level that you can cope with. And in doing that, I thought, all right, I dedicate the support for Bookstack. But when I'm creating new little things and sharing new little projects, I know at this point that I cannot do the same. I cannot sustain that with everything that I'd like to share. And it's better that I do share this rather than just thinking I won't be able to maintain the community management of that, so I just won't share it at all. So that's why on a lot of my newer projects that I've put out there, I've put a specific thing in the README. It's under a header, low maintenance project, where it makes it clear that this is a low maintenance project and I'm not looking to add any extra features. And please don't raise any new issues or pull requests for new features, because I don't really want to maintain them. But it's difficult. It's difficult because, like you said, from your user point of view, it's nearly there, just that one little thing that you want. But the trouble is, when if you've got a few thousand users and each of those users has the same kind of idea, but it's a slightly different thing, you can easily get into a cycle where you've got this amalgamation of a platform that's built with everyone's ideas. And in some cases, you might be able to support that. But in a lot of cases, that makes things quite hard to maintain, especially if they're not things that you yourself would use or be really happy to maintain over a long term. And for me, a lot of these projects are things that I do want to keep on maintaining. I do want them to work going forward. I want to keep them updated, but I don't want the hassle of having to dive into these extra little features which I'm not using or may not even be aware of in 5 years' time when I come back to it. And I don't have the time to go in and support things like pull requests to help other people's work. So, you know, if people can freely take it because it's open source. That's the beauty of it. If someone's got the skills, they can fork that and then you can tweak it to their own requirements. I appreciate that's not something that everyone can do, and it can often depend on whether you're familiar with the with their technologies. But yeah, especially with Bookstack, that was a hard lesson, because certainly when I first shared it on Reddit, I did want to please everyone and take on everyone's ideas and, you know, go towards the features that they were requesting for. But ultimately, looking back on that, those requesting things in a self-hosted subreddit weren't really my originally intended audience that I was building it for, that I'd created the design, the UX, the feature set for.
Right.
So I was adding things like a Markdown editor and LDAP authentication and things that are now quite hefty when I have to, you know, build in a new feature. There's now a lot of things to consider because of those past decisions that I made to try and get these features in to please people that are kind of outside that core scope of what I was originally building for. So that's something that I'd recommend to anyone that's thinking about sharing and building something open source, is to really nail down that scope so you know exactly what you want to build and who you're building for, and make sure that's clear to the audience, you know, on the project readme, somewhere up front and center, so that it makes it easier if someone does come along and, for example, creates a pull request for a big new feature that you don't really want to maintain, or you don't want to perform the work or add the additional testing required, or whatever it is, the extra time. It makes it easy to have something like that you can just point to and say, look, this isn't something that I'd like. Thank you very much, but I'm purposely trying to focus on this use case. So I'd have to reject your request as per our README. And that's essentially what the low maintenance project is doing. So when someone does create an issue, I can just point to that and say, this is a low maintenance project. It did say here on the README. So unfortunately, I'm just going to have to close this off because this isn't something that I want in the project. But you know, feel free to fork it and maintain it yourself.
Was saying no a skill you had to develop? Was that hard at first?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I really struggle with those social elements. It's funny because if someone's a complete, I don't know what kind of language you want on the podcast, if someone's a complete numpty, let's say, and starts being quite aggressive with you on an issue and spouting off about how this feature is ideal and why you implement it and whatnot, those kind of people I find fairly easy to deal with, because it's kind of justified. You say, right, now you're being out of order, let's close this, please stop commenting, or in the extremes might block. But it's the more nuanced cases that I found most difficult, like people providing a new feature via pull request, because people could spend time, they could spend hours, maybe even days, building something and then providing to that project, fully believing that they are providing some value back to the project and they're excited to get that part of the project, and they believe that they are making that better, which is true from a perspective. You know, they are making it better for the user that might want that feature. But from my perspective, I could receive a pull request and be looking at it and think, okay, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I'm going to have to spend a lot of time helping this person get the code up to the kind of standards and the level that I'd want for future maintenance within the project. Or even I think this isn't something that I'd want at all. Like, this isn't something that I'm willing to support. This is just outside the scope. This hasn't been discussed at all. There's no one that wants this feature, so it's not worth maintaining. So it's really difficult to go back in those cases and say, like, thank you for all your hard work, but I'm not looking for this. You know, this isn't being something that anyone's asked for, and it's not really worth maintaining. Not that their efforts aren't worth it, or that their particular code is feature itself within the scope of what I'm building Bookstack for. And it's really difficult to portray that perspective from the maintainer point of view to an end user, because until you're in their shoes, you don't know what the full cost of that is. It's like there's a popular issue for Bookstack of supporting Postgres database, which, you know, I can understand. You know, a lot of technical people out there will have favorites they might be using for something else, so it's easy to maintain.
Right.
And people post on the thread, like, they post like 10 articles all about how it's technically a better platform than MySQL, which I appreciate it might actually be. But for me, it comes down to how well established and supported is it, and also the maintenance and support cost of introducing that. And to me, I'm thinking about every time, you know, we're doing a release where someone has to update, helping people that are maybe not so technical through little scenarios, or maybe they mishandled their Docker image update and accidentally corrupted the database. I'm thinking of things like that, where that's really where a lot of my time is around those elements. So while the platform, you know, it might take me maybe a weekend to actually implement that as a feature, it's going to consume a lot of my time and then a lot of additional testing and concern in my mind about fully supporting that to the same level that we already do for the existing database. So, but it's hard to put across that cost, that level of effort, to people that basically don't have to live with that cost.
Right. Have you ever had someone create a pull request with Postgres support that you've had to turn down?
No, not with Postgres support. I can't remember what pull requests we have. We've had features that I've just had to say, yeah, just no, because this isn't something that's being requested for, and it's difficult because the intention is positive. They mean well. And then another kind of similar one, I guess, similar scenario, is that people have tried to put bounties behind issues. So that maybe there's a feature request on GitHub, and then people have tried to put money behind those to help people or help entice people to provide pull requests and code for that feature. But that's done completely without my input or approval. So that's a really awkward thing where because I have had that once where someone's then come along with a feature wanting to get that bounty. And now I'm the blocker to them getting their money, which I never had any involvement for, which I didn't offer them, which I didn't approve of. That's the whole thing. You come into all these little awkward scenarios that you kind of never imagined, you know, from the offset. You just want to share your code and just think of it from a technical point of view, but you soon get into these community social elements.
Yeah, it's surprising to hear that in 2024, with all the communication channels you have available for your work, that someone would put so much time and effort into something to add to one of your projects without ever mentioning it to you until they submit their pull request.
It comes down to not realizing the impact of that, because you probably think that's a fully positive kind of result that you're performing by performing a pull request. There's nothing negative to it. You're providing that code to the project. You're giving something. So I can see why someone might do that without communication first, because they just think it's a no-brainer. And thinking about my first contribution to open source back in, it would have been like, I don't know, 2013, 2014, was to the OpenCart project, an e-commerce platform, where I had created a pull request to improve the, like, some SEO elements of like, I don't know, manufacturer pages or something. But I mean, I imagine at the time the maintainer of the project never replied to me at all, and then eventually just closed it off after a couple of years. And, you know, at the time, I think I felt kind of salty about that, because I thought, I was giving this value. But I hadn't gone down any of those avenues first. I hadn't communicated with the project. I think that maybe there was an issue where other people were showing support, but there's nothing from the maintainer saying that they were looking to include that feature. Back then, my perspective was, oh, I'm giving value. This is something that people have said they wanted. You know, what's not to like? Why isn't this being merged? But now I can look at that with a completely different perspective, I think. You know, I was just assuming that the maintainer was going to then support this code from then on, and the burden would have been on them, and it's kind of their right. I mean, they could have communicated a little bit better, but but essentially it was their right to close off, and I shouldn't complain about that because I'd never asked for that to be added in the first place.
Right. It's an interesting dichotomy, I think, between you mentioning, and I'm glad you mentioned this because I've never heard anyone talk about this, that you understand your audience, you share things and interact with communities that you know aren't your audience, and so you understand at what level to take their feedback and how serious it is. And it's really interesting. I think Reddit's kind of an anomaly, and Reddit's really interesting to me because I see a lot of the self-hosted subreddit, I feel like I see a lot of enterprise software being pitched there, and I don't think that's an audience for enterprise software. And so I'm always like wincing when I see someone post something, and I know if I go in to read the comments, sometimes they're so abrasive that like my feelings almost get hurt for the developers because people can be kind of nasty. So you're dealing with that, but then on the other side, you're also managing other people's feelings and expectations toward your software who are putting time and effort into it and then not having their pull requests accepted. And that's super interesting to me because I haven't given that thought. And I know you and I have discussed on via Reddit comments before. I used to, and I've talked about this in a previous episode, so I'm not going to talk about it in any detail, but I wrote an article once about a really abrasive developer and his team who are nasty to people who ask for like basic support. And the more time I spend with developers and just in this environment, I understand where the impatience comes from. I don't know that I would necessarily ever excuse just being outright nasty to people in the way that some are, but I certainly am starting to understand the other side more where, hey, either you put a ton of warnings and context on the README or all across the project, like, hey, this is where I am, this is what I do and don't want, or what I will and won't accept. And I understand a lot of people just don't respect those things or look at them. So one last question for RSS, and I want to pivot into another topic before we run out of time here. Do you mind sharing what you built RSS for? Is there a novel use you had for it that wasn't met with other platforms? Or was it just like a fun side project for you to develop?
I mean, it was probably a bit of both. So there were some kind of new libraries and new technologies within that that I just wanted to learn. So that was a kind of a good test bed for that. But there was also a use case that I had a very specific idea of what I wanted from an RSS app. So I wanted to follow a whole bunch of feeds. And I have used various RSS readers in the past, but there's always just slight things that didn't work with my flow. Like they tried to include the whole article, where I always wanted to go to the original source when I click through. And I wanted clear like visual cards of the content, like you would get with Twitter, that will have the text and the primary image brought in from the article and things like that. And I'm sure there are applications that do these individual elements, but I wanted an application that just did these elements, that didn't add extra any complication, that didn't have any kind of login or user account management, because I thought that's just extra hassle. Just something that does the core simple things that I need from an RSS reader, just exactly how I envisioned it. So yeah, I think it was definitely an element of just trying to get to a point of exactly what I had in my head in terms of an app interface. And I think that's one of the nice things about being able to have some, or having some development skills, that sometimes you just got this idea and you want to get it out there. You want to build exactly to that idea. You try and find something, but it might not just fit. Or even might just be something tiny in the design. So yeah, just build it yourself.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you for it. I still use it myself personally. And will, again, make sure I don't submit any feature requests. And I respect that. And I did not mean to make it sound like I might have been calling you out for that.
Feel free if I'll just close them off.
Fine, I'm going to start doing it regularly to make you...
You're going to automate something to do it like every minute.
So I want to pivot a little bit here towards the end. I mentioned earlier that you do a lot of work in the open source world and wanted to talk to you and just get your thoughts on it a little bit and maybe how that started. So I know I've shared in my content before, you have you've put together some really cool content on the open source world and licensing and holding people accountable who might not be respecting what open source software is. And I'm not even sure respecting is the right word, because I think sometimes people accidentally misuse it. So I don't want to make it sound like everyone is malicious when they're misusing it. But I do think people do, or companies might take advantage of it because of the goodwill that's associated when you're saying something is open source. But you are, as I mentioned earlier, you are my go-to guy when I see something licensing related and it's like, hey, I want to share this in my own content, but I don't want to share it without understanding what's going on. And so thank you. I do appreciate your willingness to let me pick your brain. But to my knowledge, this feels like maybe thankless work. You're putting in a lot of time and effort. I read the repo you have with all of your documentation on people and entities you've interacted with. I can see you posting on Reddit and elsewhere really insightful and in-depth comments addressing people's concerns or maybe challenging them a little bit. So where did that come from? Is that just, you know, something you're particularly passionate about and it's a hobby you enjoy doing? Or do you feel as an open source developer yourself, it's kind of your duty to make sure you're out there and advocating for it where you can?
I mean, I don't think it's a duty that developers or open source developers specifically have to do, but it definitely is something that I'm grew passionate about, because just by over the last decade, I suppose, building a career on open source software and taking that to then build something myself and put that out in the open, and then continue to get deeper and deeper into open source and seeing more scenarios that pop up around licensing, my appreciation over time just grew and grew, and particularly into what open source essentially is and what it provides. Because someone new to open source can easily just assume that it's the code is up there and it's maybe on GitHub, it's viewable. But open source means quite a lot more to that. It, at a very general level, it means that code is open for viewing, use, modification, and distribution. And it's the combination of all of those elements that make open source powerful, because it means that the user base has a lot of agency to do what they need to do with the code, to be able to take that, to create something new from that, for it to survive beyond its original author. And so, yeah, the more time I spent with open source software and building open source software myself, the greater my understanding and appreciation for what all of those freedoms represent grew as well. And I guess as that occurred, I was spending more time in open source and spending more time on communities such as Reddit and maybe like Hacker News. And during those times, I'd also see the ways that open source may be manipulated or misrepresented in various ways to benefit the authors, while taking some of those freedoms that make open source so great, in my opinion. So I guess, yeah, then after a point, it kind of lingered in my mind, how does this happen? Why do people misrepresent open source? And how do they misuse it? Is this all coming from a singular place? So that's when I started my open source confusion cases project, just where when these cases do come up, I would query the original authors, try and learn more about why they might think in a particular way, why they might be advertising their project as open source while it not being providing those freedoms that are most commonly understood for open source. And I'll just then document them as part of that project and then move on from it, I guess, and then observe more cases, because there's only so much you can do. I don't want to ever get into a confrontational argument, at least on purpose, with a lot of these companies, because, it's their right to use whatever words they want to. It's their right to have certain beliefs. So I'm just interested in trying to find out how this occurs and where this comes from. It just became a real curiosity to me.
Sure. It's this has come up. I feel like it's been relevant in two scenarios in the last several months, at least where you and I have interacted. With the most recent being this week, I reached out to you. I saw several articles in my newsfeed throughout the week where it was X software has gone Fair Source license, Y software has gone Fair Source. And before this week, to be honest, I hadn't heard of Fair Source. And so my gut instinct or reaction was to reach out to you. So I was like, hey, what are your thoughts? And it was incredible that you had already given it a lot of time and thought, and you linked me to some things on your like confusion case scenario where you've already interacted with some of the actual platforms that had popped up in my newsfeed and maybe how they were misrepresenting. And then the second instance has been Fudo, and they've been in the news a lot, at least in the self-hosted world, because of their image acquisition. But I think your maybe any concerns you might be having about them or have had about their treatment of open source software predates that, at least from the documentation I've read that you've developed or blog posts you've developed. But I feel like maybe, at least from my perspective, and I'll say I'm not a licensing expert. When I released a couple months ago, I released a directory of self-hosted software. And one of the first feature requests I got for it was, hey, can you add an indicator for what license the software is? And I remember being so blown away by that because I don't think about that a lot when I'm looking for self-hosted software. And the more I've thought about it, I understand how important it is and I've tried to pay more attention, but I just didn't realize how important this world of licensing was to people. And I'm just wondering now with Fudo and all these other enterprise platforms who have actual companies and not just, you know, a developer in his free time working on them are pushing for these altered versions of open source. I haven't figured out if it's good or not yet, because I think a lot of the time they might have good intentions. Like, yes, open source is great. There's a lot to be said about open sourcing your work, allowing other people to use it. But it seems like it often comes down to, yeah, open source is great. We want to support it. We want to support the community, but we also have people who are working really hard on this full time and we need a way to compensate them. And there needs to be some way to monetize this, because otherwise you might not have this open source we're providing. And so when I see something pop up, I always try and remind myself of that. And sometimes it's probably not that. I'm sure some platforms are just selfish and want to take advantage of it. But I often wonder how much of it has to do with that and if that's really the struggle. And I see that on Mastodon a lot. People constantly talk about open source and supporting developers and how is open source sustainable if the general public isn't really great at donating and supporting when they're not being forced to or when it's not put right in front of their face. So where do you land on that? Do you feel similarly or?
So I think it's good to have options, and those alternative licenses that aren't widely considered open source are absolutely fair enough. So a lot of those licenses are, you know, comparing relative to open source, they'll take some of those rights of open use. So as I said earlier, open source generally provides open rights of use, modification, distribution, and viewing. So usually they'd restrict things like not being able to distribute the software in certain ways, or not being able to provide or make certain modifications, often around like licensing and user limits and things like that, or not being able to use it if you're providing it as a SaaS offering, or if you're a company over a certain size. So those are the kinds of limits that they put on projects. And my view is that it's completely fair to license your work however you wish. You know, if you need to protect your work, or if you feel the need to protect your work to keep working on that project to sustain your income, then, you know, you're completely within your rights to do that. And then as long as you're able to do based upon the licenses that the software of your project is using. So if you've got dependencies using like GPL software, that can throw spanners in the work. But yeah, if you've got the right to do so, that's completely fair enough. So my main issue comes in when there's a confusion or misrepresentation of those licenses. So if a company is saying that the software is open source, but then it limits people from being able to make modifications. I take that as an issue, and that's kind of where I then reach out to that company and see if they're doing that on purpose, seeing if they're aware of the rights that open source generally provides, and, you know, take it from there. But in terms of those existing, I think that's absolutely fine. And you touched on fair source there. That's kind of something that I was hoping would happen, because there's been a lot of contention where people have tried to release their projects under those types of licenses, calling them open source, and then got blowback from the community. And the authors of those software often say, you know, it doesn't really make any difference, it doesn't really mean anything to users. But then people that are kind of deeper into open source, that know the value of what that provides, then kind of push back and say it isn't the same. You know, you're not providing all the same rights. And that does often limit a lot of kind of major actions that might not always be taken by users, but are important for open source. So things like forking, you know, not everyone's going to fork a project. Not everyone would fork Bookstack. But it means that if I turn on the community and say, hey, it's now $500 to download it, or you got a paper seat, and start doing shifty stuff like that, or change the license myself, it means someone else can take that and build upon it and create something new successfully, because they've got all those different open rights to do so. So yeah, otherwise those licenses would commonly be referred to as source available, but the projects of those licenses generally don't like being labeled as source available, because it's a bit of a clunky term, and they just don't like it, because it combines a lot of other software that isn't open source. That is just really, I mean, you know, leaked code bases could technically be called source available. So yeah, I think by having something like Fair Source, I think they're trying to push a name like open source, in this case Fair Source, a new brand, a marketing term that they can get behind. I think that's good. So you could have something that sits adjacent to open source, so something is there for those kind of projects to use, rather than trying to change open source to become that. Because that's what's been done a lot of the time in the past. For example, Sentry, who are a driving force behind Fair Source, they put a lot of effort in the past in trying to sort of create a narrative about changing open source. It was quite clear that they wanted to do that with multiple kind of C-level people at the company via their own blogs, posting to Hacker News and Reddit and whatnot about, you know, open source is no longer sustainable, open source needs to change. And I really didn't like that contention, because it's always done with a very specific viewpoint, because I think those things probably are true from their perspective, because they are in their scenario where they are at risk from other people using their software. They do want to sustain their business. But from my point of view, they don't speak for everyone within the open source community. There are people sustaining on open source absolutely fine. What that really means is that open source isn't sustainable for them. Open source isn't sustainable for a particular revenue or growth model. And I mean, typically you see a lot of these cases come up like the VC world, where there's a lot of push for growth, a lot of push for marketing, where trying to adopt the open source label is quite valuable. So I was seeing a lot of stuff like that from Sentry. And when they were publishing or getting ready to publish their new license, the functional source license, which again holds back some of those rights for a couple of years, I tried to jump into this conversation quite early and try and, or I questioned how they're going to frame that relative to open source to try and sway them to define something new, which is what they've come out with recently with Fair Source. And these kind of licenses aren't anything new. So the Elastic license has been going on for quite a while. There's the Commons Clause, the Business Source license, but the new part here, or at least I think it has been done before, but this is a bigger push, is to create that label, create that marketing term to sit adjacent to open source, so that these companies can sit behind it as a term of branding, rather than, yeah, trying to adopt open source incorrectly from the view of a lot of people like me.
Right. So if someone like me wants to stay on top of these things, I feel like it's not easy. It's not always as easy as just going to the repository and trying to find the license they have listed. And GitHub is especially tricky because I feel like I'll often go into a repository and be like, oh, MIT license. But when you click the license tab or you link to the actual page, it's actually various licenses based on what you're looking at or what specific function within the software you're talking about. And it's not always obvious. So how does someone who maybe might not be privy to the information you are in licensing stay on top of making sure they're either holding people accountable or just able to educate themselves and identify, hey, this isn't open source or this really is open source?
So in terms of keeping up on it, I don't really have any good advice for that, because it is difficult because it's such a dynamic landscape, because there are so many different kinds of licenses. There's so many different kinds of options, and people might start creating their own licenses here and there. Sometimes you come across custom licenses. And as you said, a lot of companies really overcomplicate these things. You do go into repos, and then maybe this folder is under one license, but you go into this folder, but it's under an enterprise license. And that's another case that I try and push against, where these projects are going onto Reddit, they're saying the project is open source. But when you go onto it, the open source code depends on commercial license code that you need their permission to use. So it's really quite misleading. But yeah, it is difficult to keep on top of. And ultimately, the rights that you are provided can depend on the specific license. But there's a few little things that can help. So at least at the moment, when you go onto GitHub, if it shows you a license in the sidebar, as in there's usually a little label under the details in the right-hand side, then if it says an actual license name, like MIT license, like GPL license, that means that it is an open source license, typically. Because GitHub will only pick that up if it's a known open source license that provides those freedoms. So open source is, unfortunately, quite a complicated area, because what most consider open source to be comes from the open source definition, which is like a set of 9 rules for a license. And then you've got the OSI, who portray themselves as the steward of that definition. And then they certify licenses to say, hey, this license fits the definition, so you can consider this open source. So the OSI doesn't say which licenses. They certify particular licenses, but not every license may be certified by the OSI. But yeah, if you see a label on the sidebar, that usually means it's open source, but I have seen scenarios then maybe there's not another hidden license down in the depth. So yeah, it is unfortunately quite difficult, which is why I try and push back on it, why I try and make sure if I see anything iffy when viewing a post in the self-hosted subreddit, I will be quite brazen and put a post on there and call it out. Or I'm a moderator of the open source subreddit, so I end up removing quite a lot of posts, or actually more often I'll put a label on there saying, do you realize this isn't open source? Here's where you can find more information. And if you're an author choosing to publish some open source software, a good website is choosealicense.com, I think it is. So web page by GitHub that kind of has that takes you down some initial steps to be able to choose a license. But yeah, it's not easy, but that's why I try and help. But I think it's always going to be quite difficult.
Sure, I'll try and include some of these links we're talking about in the show notes for anyone who might be interesting. We mentioned Fudo a little bit ago. I think they're interesting in terms of, you just mentioned the open source definition. You wrote a really interesting blog post just, I don't know, a couple weeks ago now, where you were kind of pleading with them to reconsider what they're doing around it. And I think they're a really interesting use case because I don't think they have any bad intentions whatsoever. I think they're trying to evolve the mindset of how people look at open source software, or at least my impression, and especially after all of the image licensing stuff that's been going on, all the drama the last several weeks. It really seems like they're trying to create an association with, hey, yes, open source is great, but open source can't always Or it's hard to make open source free all the time because it's people who are spending time and effort in developing these resources. So it feels to me they seem to be trying to create more of an association or redefine people's expectations that, hey, open source maybe doesn't mean that you should just expect everything's yours and free to use and you don't have to think about any implications of that if all you do is go and grab the software, use it on your own and come back. I think they're trying to push everyone towards this. You know, we need to be supporting developers. There's nothing wrong with purchasing open source software as a way to support the developers, even though that does kind of put a weird taste in a lot of people's mouths. I think that's been interesting to follow as they've been trying to craft that narrative. I know you've questioned them, and I notice on a lot of your community posts where you're challenging people a little bit, you often don't get responses. I don't know if people just don't have good responses or what that is, but it leads me to think you've challenged them to the point where maybe hopefully they're reconsidering how they've represented themselves.
I mean, I think usually where if I don't get a response, it means they don't want to hear it, to be honest. And I've been banned by a few projects for raising these kind of things up with them.
Just because
they obviously don't want to have a discussion on it. Or maybe in some cases they were hoping to hide it, and you know they've just changed their license without mentioning it, and they don't want anything further. So yeah, it can be a little bit tricky in that regard. And on the Futo thing, I think they're trying to do good. They believe in good, and I don't disagree with the things that they're saying. Like they're saying that we need to be more open about paying for open source, which is the thing, by the way. Open source doesn't mean it has to be provided for free. You can charge for open source, but it just means that the user then receives the software can do whatever they want with it, pretty much. Yeah, the real contention there was that they were trying to redefine the existing term of open source to kind of fit with their desires of something different to open source, without considering the importance of that to the community. And a lot of the things in their definition would take away fundamental rights from users of the software, and retain those protections, those rights to the authors instead, which isn't specifically a bad thing. They probably would, you know, they're doing that with a good intention because they do want to sustain their developers, and I mean they do it under the name of preventing malware and things like that. But essentially, once you start making that rules, it takes away a lot of what makes open source open source, because it retains the rights to the author, so that, you know, if they start doing something shifty down the road, it means the users of that software don't have as much agency to, you know, take that and start something new, or for a new company to build from that, or to start a fork, or to develop it, maybe something quite different but adjacent using that original code base. So it changes a lot of the dynamics of what's possible and what rights users have. And again, that's fine, but you know, just don't change open source to suit that need, because it's just a different way of thinking from a different perspective. It's quite, you know, they're thinking somewhat inwardly, which is fair enough. And whereas open source, you kind of got to be committed to sharing publicly. You're giving away those rights. And that's something that, you know, it's important to understand if you're putting something out there as open source. You know, understand your license, understand what that enables you to do. As you see a lot of these big companies, you know, they change up their license saying, oh no, Amazon's taking all our work and is providing services, and that's really bad for us. But Amazon are only doing what they're allowed to do within the license that's been provided. And if that was going to be fundamental to your business strategy, if that was fundamental to your business income, then, you know, you should have fully caught that earlier. That was a fundamental license on your main project that you're providing.
That's really insightful. Thank you again for the work you do on that. And thank you for always lending your opinion when I need it. It's always super helpful, and you always seem to stay on top of that.
I'm happy to provide input.
With that being said, I do think it's probably time to wrap up here. Thank you again for a great conversation. Thank you for Bookstack. Thank you for RSS. Thanks again for the work you do in open source. I am going to link to everything we talked to today in the show notes for anyone who wants to follow up on any of the topics or miscellaneous articles we might have mentioned. I'm also going to drop some links for anyone who'd like to support Dan and the work he's done. Even if you're not directly deploying one of his projects, I have a feeling he's probably, or he might have influenced something in some way or another that might have influenced something, you know, any listener might be using. So again, please consider that if you're listening to this and have benefited from Dan's work in any form or fashion. Otherwise, thanks a lot, Dan. I look forward to submitting a bunch of feature requests on RSS moving forward.
No, thank you absolutely for having me. And thanks for also the content that you put out to the open source and self-hosted community. And it's the same with other, you know, journalists creating videos and articles and content. As an author, it means a massive amount when we see our work recognized and featured and shared across avenues. So yeah, a massive shout out to yourselves and similar blogs and everyone that helps the community.
Sure thing. Well, thanks again, and thanks everyone for listening.